Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Katayama, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. Our studio is currently closed due to the outbreak of COVID-19 caused by coronavirus in New York City, so we are recording this episode remotely. It may sound a little different than usual, but we're happy to have technology that allows us to keep making a regular programming. So let's start our show. So this show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Aman Cohen, who is a chef and owner of Dirt Candy in Lower East Side and co-owner of Lekka Burger in Tribeca, both in Manhattan. Amanda has been cooking vegetarian food for the last 20 years, since when vegetarians are in the absolute minority. She is a James Beard Award-nominated chef and definitely a pioneer of the vegetable-forward movement in America. And Amanda visited Japan in December 2019 to discover vegetarian food culture in the country. As you may know, Japan is a Buddhist society and had a heavily restricted meat consumption policy that lasted 1,200 years until the end of 19th century. So it's a very interesting situation over there. So today we'll discuss what Amanda discovered in Japan, how she applies discoveries to her dishes in New York City, what vegetarian cuisine means in a modern society, and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Japanese is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japanese. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have ideas about the topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japanese@heritageradio.org or kikokatema.com. Now let's start a conversation with Amanda Cohen. Hello, Amanda. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
So this is my first remote show, so it's kind of exciting. But how are you?
I'm good. I am surviving at the moment. The restaurant is closed, so I guess I get a holiday.
Yeah. Well, we just have to wait until things passes, and well, we're fine. So let's just try to be positive and enjoy the moment.
Exactly. It's day by day, and there's absolutely nothing I can do. So might as well go with it.
Yep. Okay. So first of all, I think many people don't know you yet. We have a wide audience. Currently, we have over 19 audience in 190 countries. So let me ask you, where you're from and what did you eat when you grew up?
I'm from Canada, Toronto to be exact.
Mm, that's why you're so nice.
Pardon?
That's why you are so nice.
Yeah, exactly. And what's the second question? What I wanted to be when I grew up?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think I ever knew what I wanted to do. I just, you know, I like to cook a lot. And one day I realized I needed to get a job. So the only thing that I thought I might possibly want to do is cook, and I stuck with it.
Okay. Yeah, actually, the sound is awful, but my second question was, what did you eat when you grew up in Canada?
What did I eat? Canada's a pretty special country, I would say, because we have a lot of different cultures there, and so it really influenced our food growing up. You know, from a really young age, we ate all different kinds of food, like there is no such thing as like really Canadian food. Lots of different ethnic food, lots of different kinds of, you know, we ate like Indian and Chinese and Italian, Portuguese, Jamaican. I will say that I probably didn't eat a lot of Japanese food growing up, though.
Mm. Okay. So then when and why did you get into vegetarianism?
You know, when I was 15, which was about 30 years ago, all my friends were becoming vegetarians. They were sort of very politically aware, and they were very environmentally conscious and animal rights conscious, and they all became vegetarians. And I wish I had a better answer, but really I just followed suit. I just did what they did. I happened to, as it turned out, I was always vegetarian. We just didn't really know it. Like when I became one, I said I became, I was one. It didn't change my eating habits at all. I just had always never really eaten the meat anyways.
Wow. So because you really thought vegetables were your favorite food taste-wise?
Yeah, I really liked them. I love the flavor of them, and I didn't like the flavor of meat. I mean, I certainly love vegetables now more than I did as a kid. I was always more drawn to them.
Mm. Because you had a good access to good produce when you grew up?
Yeah, I think we did. You know, the produce in Canada was pretty amazing, especially, you know, in the summer months and during a growing season. We're in farm country. Toronto is a big city, but right outside of it, it's a big, big farm area. And what we had was pretty spectacular. The center of Toronto has always been this amazing farmer's market. So it sort of ran the city for a while.
Right. So that's interesting, right? People tend to think like people become vegetarian or vegan because it's good for the environment or health, but you had a natural interaction to vegetarianism. So I think that you're very lucky too.
Yeah, I think so.
Right. So how and where did you learn how to cook vegetables? I mean, in vegetarian or vegan ways?
Yeah, so I had gone to cooking school, and it was a vegetarian cooking school. And so for many years, I worked in the vegetarian kitchens of New York City. I also worked in some mainstream ones, but by and large, I probably worked in more vegetarian ones. And that started giving me a basis of how to cook vegetables. But everything I thought I knew when I opened my restaurant, I realized I knew nothing. And it was a vegetarian and a vegetable restaurant. I mean, we called it a vegetable restaurant from the beginning. But I realized very quickly that I didn't know as much as I thought I knew. And so we started looking at the kitchen more as a lab. I really, you know, every day we were like, okay, how are we going to experiment? What are we going to learn about vegetables? And we came in and we tested and tried to discover as much as possible.
Mm, interesting. So I think you went to the New York City, the Natural Gourmet School. Is that a culinary school specialized
yeah.
in? Okay. Yeah, I think it's interesting. Not many people know there's a specialized culinary school for like natural and vegetable-oriented program. So that's interesting. Okay. So the Natural Gourmet Institute is now part of the International Culinary Institute.
Yes. Yes.
Right? So, all right. And before you opened Dirt Candy in 2008, so you said you worked in different kitchens. Where did you work?
So, let's see. I worked in Whole Foods. I worked in a restaurant called Other Foods. I worked at a restaurant called Pure Food and Wine. I worked at Mesa Grill for a number of years. I worked at a diner in Spanish Harlem for way too long. And then I worked in some bakeries and a couple of other vegetarian restaurants. Heirloom. I worked at a place called Heirloom. I'm trying to remember my whole resume now. Lots of very different things. I worked at a summer camp for a while.
Right. So back then, the situation is very different. Now, being a vegan and a vegetarian is a cool thing to be. But back then, it was not. It's totally not a, you know, mainstream thing to do.
Yeah, no, not at all. And, you know, having now been in this city cooking for a long time, it's amazing to see the change. And just to go back for a second, one of the things that's most amazing to me, and I hope one day there's a lot more recognition for it, is, you know, everything that we learned at the Natural Gourmet, and that I was there at this point over 20 years ago, we're all cooking that way now. Yeah, we're using ingredients we were talking about in the school 20 years ago, and we're using techniques, and we're using ideas that, you know, the school was so ahead of its time. And it's pretty amazing to see how not only that has sort of come into its own, but also how many more vegetarian and vegan places there are in the city. I never could have imagined it.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm curious how people's health are going to be improved, or it doesn't change. I don't know. Yeah, it's only mere 20 years. It's a big difference. So we'll see what happens. So for listeners who have never been to Dirt Candy, which opened in 2008, what is the concept and what kind of dishes do you serve there?
So Dirt Candy is an all-vegetable restaurant, and we really, really mean that. We're not vegetable-forward. We don't have a couple of vegetable dishes. We are all about celebrating vegetables, and every dish is based on one vegetable. Even our cocktails have them. Our desserts have them. We really want, when people come to dinner here, to feel that they're sort of in a vegetable wonderland.
Yeah, and I've been to your place many times, but I think one of the most impressive things about your food is it's so visibly, impressively beautiful. So is that something you try to make it more, you know, enticing, people get more interested in having fun with vegetables?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's twofold. I love making dishes pretty. That's, you know, making food is very satisfying, but it's really fun to make them beautiful. But I'm also really fortunate. You know, vegetables are inherently colorful. And so there's a lot more you can do with them. Like, I think about putting a piece of meat, and there's nothing wrong with eating meat, but I think of putting a piece of meat on a plate, I'm like, well, that's not actually that pretty. But you put a couple of vegetables on a plate, and you're like, ooh, that really is pretty. They're just beautiful to look at.
Right. That is so true. It's like even, you know, pizza margherita does classic because of the color red. I think that makes a big difference.
Exactly. Exactly. And so you don't have to do that much more work to make them beautiful. But if you do that much more work, if you just, you know, fuss a little bit, you can end up with something extraordinary.
Right. And also your dishes, it's a beyond just one or two colors. There's so many different elements in terms of flavors too. So yeah, really, if your listeners have not been there, it's Dirty Candy. It's amazing. So, and it's fun.
Yeah, I really believe dinner should be fun, you know. You should never feel very serious when you're eating.
Yeah. Right. So it has to be fun. All right. So what is the most challenging aspect of cooking plant-based food, like the vegetarian or vegan, for you?
I think it's twofold. One, just actually the labor involved in it. It's incredibly labor intensive, and it's sometimes hard to get our guests or customers to understand how much labor goes into one dish. And so we're always sort of walking this fine line where we want to do really exciting food, but we have to often pull ourselves back a little because it's going to be too much work. And if it becomes too much work, then I'm going to have to charge a lot more. And we're still finding that customers don't necessarily want to pay that much money for vegetables. And then vegetables just aren't a luxury ingredient yet. And then the other part of it is, and it's the fun part, but it's the hard part, is there really is no roadmap. And so having now done this for 11 years and feel very much like a pioneer in it, you know, there is no encyclopedia really on what to do with vegetables. There's not a lot of recipes out there for creative vegetable dishes, and having to always sort of figure out the next big thing can sometimes be a little challenging.
Right. Yeah. Like I started to see more, you know, many restaurants at least have vegan or vegetarian dishes at fine dining or, you know, regular restaurants. And I see, like, for example, cauliflower steak. And it's a steak of cauliflower, which is delicious, but it's very expensive for, you know, steak of cauliflower. But there's no offense, but, you know, but your efforts, like, one of my favorite dishes, the spinach milfeel.
Yeah.
And the puff pastry, right? And layered soup concentrated spinach mousse, smoked pistachio butter, and lilac spinach, dehydrated grapefruit, and smoked pistachio salad. So it's not a joke. You had a lot of work into it.
It's a lot of work, but I'm impressed you remember that dish. It was one of my favorite too. It's so pretty.
Right. And you have a lower east side, bigger space, but when you're still a East Village, it's a tiny, tiny little space. And was it 8 seats or something?
It was 18 seats.
Before you moved to a bigger space. Yeah. So, yeah, everybody's fighting for your seat. And you came a long way. So, congratulations.
I know. From my baby restaurant to my normal sized restaurant.
Right. So let's talk about your trip to Japan in December last year. So I heard that you went to Japan by the invitation of the Tokyo Visitors and Convention Bureau, which is a Japanese government organization. So how were you selected for the trip and what was your mission?
The mission was to go and explore vegan and vegetarian food in Tokyo, specifically Tokyo too. I accepted the challenge. That was the mission, and I accepted the challenge. The idea was to see what was there and to try to, you know, bring back a little bit of my knowledge and share it with New York City.
Mm. So how did they find you for the mission?
Through a common friend of ours, Michael Harlan Turkle. He had been working with them, and he had actually sort of suggested it as a trip as they were trying to figure out their next tourism campaign.
Mm, okay. So, by the way, Michael Hunter-Kill, he does everything, and he's also the host of the food scene on the Heritage Radio Network. And he went to Japan for his book, The Acid Trip, and he discovered so many things about Japanese vinegar, and that makes sense. He knows a lot of Japanese vegan and vegetarian scenes, and so that makes sense. And he went on the trip with you, right?
Yep, we traveled all around Tokyo together.
Okay, so and as I said at the beginning of the show, the Japanese were prohibited from eating meat for 12 centuries, from year, I think, 675 to 1871. And in the 17th century, Emperor Temmu banned consumption of cattle, horse, dogs, chickens, and monkeys, whatever, not why the monkeys, but to treat animals humanely, and also to follow the philosophy of Buddhism that animals and humans are both equally part of the nature that surrounds you. So technically, you could still eat meat except for the five animals, such as white birds and hare. But Japanese diet developed over time based on fish and vegetables for this regulation, I think. So let's talk about what vegetarian foods you discovered in Japan. And the first, what cities did you visit with Michael, and how did you coordinate the places to visit?
So we only went to Tokyo, and we went to multiple places in Tokyo. And you know, Michael did a lot of research before we went. He had a long list of places that he wanted to explore, and Tokyo Tourism worked with him to set up a lot of the appointments. So doors were open for us that I think normally wouldn't be.
Mm, right. So that makes sense. It was by invitation of the Tokyo Visitors Convention Bureau. So you concentrate on Tokyo. That makes sense. There's so many places.
Yeah.
All right. So let's take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about Amanda's many, many inspiring discoveries in Japan. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. The knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they are located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit corin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japanese Podcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Amanda Cohen, who is chef and owner of Dirt Candy in Lower East Side and co-owner of Becca Burger in Tribeca in Manhattan. She is a James Beard Award-nominated chef and definitely one of the pioneers of the vegetable board movement in America. We've been talking about her recent visit to Tokyo. So let's talk about the places you visited. So first, I heard you went to the Yuba or Tofu Skin Factory, which is an essential ingredient for vegetarian vegan cooking in Japan. So what did you find there?
The Yuba was amazing. I'm very familiar with Yuba. We've tried to make it in our kitchen before and have had some success, but it's never turned out as good as it could. And we were so...
Yuba is basically, it's a thin skin formed by boiling soy milk, right? That's how you make
it. It is. And I think that as we've sort of been discussing and looking into it a little bit more, you have to use very good soybeans. So I think the ones that we're able to get and make our soy milk out of, the soy milk can often be delicious, but it's just not the right kind to make yuba. So there's something a little missing.
So that means that you have to, the good soybeans means you need a lot of protein.
Yeah, I think, yes, exactly. And fresh, I'm not sure how fresh our soybeans are. So at the Yuba factory, we got this really special tour. We got to go downstairs and pull the yuba, which was amazing. It smelled so good. And as soon as they pulled it off, the boiling soy milk, we were allowed to eat it. And I've never had anything so fresh and soft and luscious. It was incredible.
Is that like a crepe?
Yeah, like a hot, chewy, soft crepe.
Nice. Okay. Right. So,
but also really creamy because the soy milk is creamy, so you get everything at once.
So if you want to use it, how do you use yuba in general and, you know, in your way?
Well, so currently we use it. We actually have it deep fried, and they're like little chips for one of our dishes. Because yuba deep fried is just the crunchiest, crackliest, most delicious thing. But we also, we served it. We did a sort of a Japanese day here at the restaurant where we remade with some of my impressions, some of the dishes that we had in Japan, and we made the yuba into noodles. We deep fried them. We put them in a broth. Like, there's so much you can do with them. You can have soft noodles, crunchy noodles, chewy noodles, plain, just yuba plain with a little bit of soy.
So it sounds like it's not discovered fully enough in this country, but the yuba is often used in shojin ryori, which is a vegetarian cuisine, and the shojin was brought to Japan, I think, in the 13th, 14th century from China, and it's based on a principle of Buddhism. That's why it's served in temples and certain restaurants in Japan. So, yeah, usually it's cooked in dashi and very delicate, but the way you use it is expanding the opportunities, possibilities of yuba. So that's exciting.
Oh, yeah, I think there's, I mean, to me, it's such an undiscovered food. If it would be a dream of mine if I could open a yuba restaurant. I love the texture of it.
Right. Well, I'm sure if you have a yogurt shop, you're going to get a lot of customers from other restaurants too. So maybe you should put it in your plan in the future. all right. And I heard that you took a class of rice cooking as well.
I did. It was really, really interesting. So we did this rice workshop with Momoko Nakamura, who's also known as the Rice Girl. She has a rice subscription, but based on the 24 micro seasons of rice, which is pretty interesting, even thinking of 24 micro seasons. You know, in North America, we think of seasons as 4, summer, fall, winter, spring, and this idea of these micro seasons that really blew my mind when she started talking about it. And she's right, clearly. I mean, things don't grow at once. Micro seasons are really true. And so I probably won't do it justice, but how she talked about rice and when it was grown and when it was picked and when you're supposed to use certain rices, it really sort of changed how I was. What I had thought about rice. You know, to me, rice is something that comes in a bag. Sometimes it's white, sometimes it's brown. Sometimes it's a little fancier, sometimes it's less. But this idea that it could be as sort of bespoke as any other ingredient, you know, like a vegetable, it has a season and it changes with the seasons. It's pretty amazing.
I've never thought of that. Rice can be seasonal, so... Yeah, and actually, I learned about her from you, I contacted her. I'm hoping that she's going to be on my show, and I was waiting for her.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and I was surprised. She was born and raised in Japan, in the States, and he moved to from LA to Tokyo in 2015, I heard. So that's a very interesting. But she's very objective to Japanese culture, but very... I think he just has a deep understanding because she's a Japanese-American. So it's interesting.
Yeah, and I really like that it's sort of she came back for rice. And it's just this, what we think of as a staple, it's so much more than just a staple. It's not just a grain of rice. Every grain of rice tells a story. And the way she talks about it, it's really engaging.
Mm, okay. So did you cook rice with her? That's the class.
She showed us how she cooked rice, which was, it's how you cook rice. It wasn't sort of a newfangled way. Put water, wash the rice, put it in a pot, have it come to a boil. But I will say one of the things that was interesting, and, you know, rice is sometimes fussy. And I think we always blame it on ourselves, like, oh, I cooked the rice wrong. And then watching her cook the rice and her talking about the rice, she's like, you know, sometimes rice has more moisture, sometimes it has less. You really have to know what rice you're cooking with and when it was picked, because it is going to change how much water you need to put in or how the rice is supposed to be. Some rice is supposed to be a little bit wetter. Some is supposed to be drier. It's the nature of the kernel.
Mm. So now that makes me understand why sushi chefs take 10 years to master how to cook sushi rice.
Yeah. It makes so much more sense. They know their rice intimately.
Mm. Right. Okay. And so you also went to a wagashi shop? Japanese traditional sweets. So what do you think about Japanese sweets?
You know, they were good. They were very, very different from American sweets.
Right. But they can be vegan easily, right? Because it's not much milk or dairy.
Yeah, actually, all of them, I think, were vegan. I don't think we had a single sweet that wasn't. And I like them, actually. It's a very different sort of, for me, different concept of sweet. It's so much more about texture than it is about sort of getting a sugar rush. You know, and I think of American sweets are really, they're really sweet and you eat them because you want to have a little bit of sugar. And that's what's satisfying. And when I was eating a lot of the Japanese sweets, it's so much more about getting the satisfaction from the texture.
Mm, right. So usually you know, Japanese wagashi sweets tend to be with mochi or azuki beans or both or fruits and not, you know, not eggs or dairy. So it's kind of more protein and there's a lot of sugar in it too, but it's in a way kind of healthy way of satisfaction that you can get more easily, I think.
Yeah, and I felt that it really was satisfying in a way that you didn't have to eat a lot. And everything was portionally, like, was perfectly sized, and you would have your sweet, and then you'd go on with your day versus, you know, you eat a little bit of sugar, and then you want more sugar, and then more sugar, and you become addicted to it.
Right. Right. And the other thing about wagashi is it's so seasonal, and it's seasonal by looking, too. So it's visually beautiful, stunning, and then you can see, by going to wagashi shop, you can know what season you are in now.
Yeah, no, and that's really neat. And that's one of the sort of, one of the takeaways from my trip to Japan, which is how seasonal everything really is. It's neat. Like, you don't see candy shops here, sweet shops here, changing what they offer really based on the seasons. I mean, strawberries come into season and fine strawberries are offered, but everything else is still offered. And in so many of the stores we went into and restaurants, if it wasn't in season, it wasn't served.
That is so true. Yeah, that's the essence. I think if you have to pick one essence of Japanese cuisine, I think that's the seasonality. So, yeah. And speaking of, so you went to, you had the pop-up dinner with Japanese female chefs to make a multi-course pop-up dinner at the Tsurutokame. That means crane and taro. That's a cute name. That's in Ginza. And I heard chefs were all female, which sounds very innovative because, you know, it's a very traditionally male-dominant culture in Japanese food industry. So, and you are a board member of Women Chefs and Restaurants in the U.S. So how did you find the all-female chef restaurant?
That was the best time. I cannot tell you how much fun it was. First, everybody was so gracious and so kind. I mean, you know, there I am, and I don't really speak much Japanese. Most of the women in the kitchen spoke a little bit of English, and they were also welcoming and really, you know, I do a lot of dinners in different kitchens, and there's always this moment where everybody's sort of trying to show off what they do, you know, and you're like, well, I'm worthy of being here because this is my dish that I'm going to serve, and the other chef does the same thing, and that certainly was not what happened to me when I walked into this kitchen. Everybody was just so genuinely open and excited and curious. All the female chefs there were as curious about what I was doing as I was about what they were doing. And we really, really shared a lot of information. And there were so many questions being asked. And it just felt so collaborative. And, you know, these female chefs, they work really, really, really hard. And it was very inspiring.
Right. Well, it sounds like it's a new kind of space. They serve traditional Japanese cuisine, basically, right?
Yeah. Traditional, but I would say with a little bit of a modern twist.
Like some, I don't think of caviar foie gras, but kind of like Western ideas or kind of difference?
Yeah, I mean, all the ingredients are Japanese, but there's some like different techniques that they're using, I think, so that it certainly, the kaiseki follows the traditional formula, but there's some surprises, things that I don't think you'd see at any other kaiseki. They're really putting their own spin on it. And it's interesting, and I often, when I travel, I don't go back to a restaurant again because I've eaten there, and you know, I'm like, well, time to move on to the next one. Even in New York City, I barely go back to the same restaurant. And I am so excited to go back to Tokyo one day and see what they are up to.
Right. Well, definitely it's going to be on my list. So that's Tsurutokame in Ginza. Right. Okay. And
the most exciting part about them is they all take singing lessons together, and the whole staff, every single person in the kitchen will sing you happy birthday if it's your birthday.
That's so awesome. Wow. So it's just beyond the framework, far beyond the framework of traditional kitchen. I think it's in anywhere in the world, it's hard to find this kind of place, I think. So it's open and like the growth minded.
Open and giving it. And really, it, you feel as soon as you walk in that you are part of a community. It's very, very different than any other restaurant that I have ever been to.
Wow. Okay. So I can't wait to go there myself next time I go to Tokyo. So the pop-up dinner, what was the theme of the dinner?
You know, I think it was just this idea that we would sort of share the night together or share, it was actually a lunch, share the lunch together. So they did, the idea was that I would introduce some of my food to some of their customers and some of the media in Japan. And they would get to do the same.
So what did you cook?
It was tricky because I was trying to, you know, with my limited knowledge of Japanese cuisine, I didn't want to do anything that would stuck out too much. And so I wanted to do something that would, you know, fit in enough with, A, what I could make there. Flying halfway across the world and having to cook can get really complicated sometimes. And I didn't want to do something that I wouldn't be able to find the ingredients for. So there's a lot of back and forth on what I should make. So we started with a roasted butternut squash consomme that we've been making at Dirt Candy, which is just really, really just flavorful, clear butternut squash broth. And I thought it would be a nice sort of introduction to the way I think of food, which is, here's a vegetable, look at what you can do with it. And then I did the portobello mousse, which has been on my menu since day one. And I felt it's just a really iconic Dirt Candy dish. And if I'm going to fly around the world and cook, that's the dish that I want people to taste and remember me by.
Yeah, that's like, it's interesting, I guess. Sorry, that this, your portobello mushroom mousse, that's like, you know, almost tastes like a foie gras. I can't believe it's only mushrooms. So I'm so glad you served it there.
Yeah, I am good. I'm really glad I did too. And I think that sort of, you know, one of the, it doesn't have the most, it doesn't have a really big taste, but it's one of the things that I also learned from Japan. And I'm glad I was able to sort of cook along the same lines, which is that dish is so much about texture. And I found so much of the food in Japan would be so delicately flavored, but have such an interesting texture. And so even though it's a very Amanda Cohen, New York City dish, when I started thinking about how sort of texturally soft and luscious it was, and I'm thinking about a lot of the like food that I was eating in Japan, it made a lot of sense. And then the last dish I did, because I just wanted to have fun, was I did our tiny little carrot burger.
Wow. Wow. Is that like a Leka burger? You know, burger that you say?
No, it's not a Leka one. It's a tiny little carrot slider where the actual burger is just a disc of carrots. And then we have a carrot bun and a special sauce. That was a big hit.
Okay.
People laughed when it came out and they were excited. And I was like, you know, I'm from New York City. I'm from America. It's hard not to do a burger.
Well, maybe you can send me the photos of the dishes and I can post it on the show page. That'd be great. All right. So they made it Japanese style dishes to go along with your dishes, or they didn't?
No, they did. They did some of their own signature dishes.
Do they do the kind of pop-up with other chefs at the restaurant?
No, this is the first time they've ever done it.
Sounds like they had a lot of fun, so they might do another one, but we'll see. So,
yeah, I hope they do it again. I really, really do. Yeah.
All right. And what other places did you find interesting and inspiring during your trip? You can share a little more.
So we went to the farmer's market one of the farmers markets, which is very small compared to what I would think, like what we would think of as a New York City farmers market. But it was pretty amazing, the produce. It was so beautiful and so hyper seasonal again. It was only, I don't know, maybe 20 stalls, and I could have spent 2 days there just touching and looking at every single thing.
Right. Yeah, I think they also are very into beautiful shapes and colors. So Japanese people tend to be obsessed with
yeah,
how it looks.
Yeah, just incredible. And then we ended up actually having lunch here twice at circumstances. We didn't realize we were going back to the same place twice, but we went to a place called Mike. There's a female chef who actually went to the same school I did many years after, and who is Japanese, and her name is Keiko-san, and she started this restaurant. It's tiny, maybe 8 seats. It's in a former garage, and she cooks really sort of healthier, natural foods. A lot of like rice and seaweeds, but it was beautiful and delicious. And it's not the kind of food that I would necessarily, you know, when I travel, I'm not like, oh, I should go to a vegetarian restaurant and eat a plant-based meal and have it be all healthy. And I would have been so disappointed if I had missed this. What she's doing is pretty special.
Right. Okay. And so what's the name again for listeners want to go there?
Mike, M-I-Q-U-E. And so beautiful. You can, and like her plates, they're just these little works of art.
Right. So, wow. That's another place I have to go. And also you went to the cocktail bar, Bob Ben Fittich in Shinjuku. That's what I heard.
I went where?
Like a bit. The cocktail bar.
Oh, yeah, the cocktail bar. Yes. Definitely had some cocktails. That was really fun.
Right. So fruits and vegetables. Used in cocktails?
Yeah, so we at Ben Fittich, you know, you're they're basically like, what vegetable do you feel like today? And you're like, I don't know, I guess I feel like an onion. And they'll make you an onion cocktail. They sort of look you up and down and think, okay, you want an onion cocktail? You look like a bourbon person, and I'm going to make you an onion bourbon cocktail. And then, you know, it's really interesting because they take everything from scratch and make it, basically. You have to be patient for your cocktail. It takes definitely like a good couple of minutes to get to you. But it's amazing. You know, we watched them. I think my first cocktail was a yellow pepper cocktail. And we watched them mash a yellow pepper by hand and got this really beautiful, thick yellow pepper puree. So it was just so unbelievably like fresh and flavorful and aromatic, and you know, then all the preparation that went into the cocktail, and 10 minutes later there's this like sort of basically just yellow pepper cocktail in front of you that's delicious, also served in a yellow pepper. Wow. So the whole thing was fun.
Well, I'm sure it's more nutritious too.
Yeah, exactly,
you know, the fresh vegetables, right? So, okay, and I heard the name is Bob Ben Fittich.
Yeah, exactly. It's one of the top bars in the world, and I definitely second that.
Okay, and so do you think it was easy to find vegetarian and vegan food in Tokyo? Because, you know, dashi, which is the essential stock used for the majority of Japanese dishes, is normally made of kombu and cured bonito, which is not vegan or vegetarian. So it can be a little challenging, I think. So how did you like?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is definitely challenging. It's there, but you have to know where to look. So there is like an underground vegan, vegetarian community, I would say. And there's actually like, a couple of places we went into had books all about it and maps about where to find like vegan and vegetarian restaurants. And so it's there. I certainly think if you're vegan or vegetarian, you will find lots of delicious food. And I felt like a lot of the sort of more chain restaurants, and that doesn't make them bad. It just means they have lots of locations, offered something vegetarian. Like that was for sure. Most of them had it. Like we went to Korea and there was vegetarian, and a couple of the ramen places that had more than one location had a vegetarian ramen option. But the sort of more one-off smaller places, you know, being vegetarian just seemed really foreign. They just, you know, it was hard. I had a lot of discussions with people where it felt like they just couldn't imagine being vegetarian and finding vegetarian food in Japan, and that it would be too hard to make Japanese food vegetarian. And I think there's so much there to play with and so much to do. And I know how important dashi is, but you know, I feel like there's ways where you can, and there are definitely delicious vegetarian dashis.
Right. Yeah, I think the government is seriously discussing what they should do about offering proper vegan and vegetarian because of the Olympics coming up. And you know, the halal or some certain, like, I don't think people took it seriously because vegetables are everywhere. Dashi is not going to kill you. So it's kind of like, okay. So I think it's going to change soon, though, well, thanks to the Olympics.
Well, and I think it has to, because otherwise all of it, you know, there's lots of sort of like veggie burger places and vegetarian food that wasn't, let's say, traditionally Japanese food. And those places, if they don't sort of figure out how to offer more Japanese or more vegetarian food, are going to lose out.
Right. Yeah. And if you go to Japanese restaurants in New York City, they are capable to offer vegan and vegetarian versions, because if you replace bonito with just kombu to make dashi, that's possible, for instance. So yeah, I don't think it's too difficult to do it.
No, and you know, I had so many beautiful meals in Japan, and I certainly didn't feel, and every single one of them was vegan or vegetarian, and I didn't feel like I was missing out.
Right. So what do you think is the biggest difference between American and Japanese vegetarian cultures?
Actually, the only difference is the size and how much more accepted it is now to be vegetarian in North America than it is in Japan. You know, I feel like Japan is a couple of years behind in their mindset about vegetarians and plant-based food.
Right. So hopefully, again, the Olympics is going to push them forward quickly to change that mindset.
Oh, yeah. And then I think we should all be nervous, because I think the food that's going to come out of Japan that's plant-based and vegetarian is going to blow us all away.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And so what did you learn from the trip overall, to summarize your discoveries?
You know, I guess there's two parts. One, I'm always impressed by the level of service when I'm in Japan, and just how kind and welcoming hosts are. And it's a really good reminder over and over to me to be a better restaurant host. My other big takeaway was, you know, in New York City, we're always looking for the next big flavor and the next big thing. And I feel like as a chef, we're always trying to outdo other chefs with, oh, taste this. It's so big. It's so spicy. It's so salty. It's so bitter. And in Japan, there were so many moments when I was eating, when again, I was just so consumed with the texture and the calmness of the dish. And that inspired me. And I want to take that a little bit more into my cooking and refine it and not fight for flavors, but instead sort of find the soothing, calm parts of food.
Interesting. Because it's not uncommon to find restaurants that's been, you know, successful for over 10, even 20 years in Japan. And the rating systems in Japan, it doesn't dominate the life of, you know, lifespan of restaurants. So it's more accepting and kind of a nurturing food industry culture in Japan. So yeah, that's why I think the calmness of dishes become possible, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's amazing. It was intimidating and inspiring.
Right. All right. So, I look forward to finding, you know, something you're discovering in Japan comes to new dishes, something reflective at Dirt Candy. So do you have any plans to change menu items?
Yeah, we've actually, we have a couple of items that we've already put on that have been inspired by the trip. We have it's not vegan, but it is vegetarian. Although we do have a vegan version, but we have a chawanmushi. I'd had a delicious one at Store Takame. And at the same time, in a separate dish, they had this really, really interesting okra dish. Okra was very much so in season at the time. And they did something incredibly beautiful that I don't think my customers are ready for here. They pounded it a lot. So it was very gelatinous, but full of texture, full of flavor. And I kind of actually combined the two. So now we have a chawanmushi dish with a very, very thinly sliced okra that's been steamed. And then on top, I have actually made a very light gumbo broth, because gumbo in the American South does use okra. So it kind of, it's Dirt Candy, but it's also Japanese. And then we also have, which I'm really excited about, a spinach ramen. We ate quite a bit of vegan ramen in Tokyo, and it was good. I just felt constantly that it veered more on the side of healthy than, you know, like comforting. And so we have this really, I think, beautiful roasted spinach broth. And there's a little bit of smoked miso in there. And then we have a scallion oil, and we have spinach ramen noodles, and some roasted spinach on top, and the lilac spinach from the spinach meal say. So it's quite beautiful, the whole dish, but it's also really comforting. And it's my perfect bowl of ramen as a vegetarian.
Right. Wow. Okay. So, as of tonight, the New York City restaurants are going to be closed, unfortunately. So as soon as they reopen, I'll come and taste the ramen and everything else. So I hope it's going to be soon.
Please do.
Right. So for our listeners, where can we find you online?
So Instagram, which is where I do the most of my social media work, is Dirt Candy NYC. And we also have our website, which is Dirt Candy NYC.
Right. Cool. All right. So thank you for joining us today, Amanda, and good luck with everything.
Thank you. You as well.
Right. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or at kikotema.com. Japan Needs is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. My engineer is Matt Patterson, and thank you for listening, and be safe. Well, everyone, thank you.
Japan Needs is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.